right, good evening. Sorry for the couple of minutes late start. I'm delighted to be opening the session this evening on constitutions under stress, but I noticed on the way in the sign says citizens of nowhere and then constitutions under stress. And of course, the current British Prime Minister, in her speech to the Conservative Party conference, suggested that if anyone thinks they're a citizen of the world, they are completely misguided and they are citizens of nowhere. She's clearly, obviously, very keen to go back to issues of national identity. And national identity and Britishness have underpinned a lot of the thinking that led to the whole Brexit debate, has led to the British Constitution being under some stress. But as the United Kingdom prepares to leave the European Union, we're not the only country to have a constitution under stress. We are particularly this evening focusing on the UK case with an issue of the French constitution, but if people want to throw in issues about the United States and the Trump presidency when we get to Q&A, you'll be most welcome to do so. So we have three speakers who are going to focus on the UK side of things. Richard Toy is going to open because he's going to give a historical perspective. We're then going to move to Scott, who is going to talk about the Miller case, which obviously had its culmination in the Supreme Court on Tuesday, leading the government to produce a bit of a drafting almost overnight. So there is now a draft bill on withdrawing from the European Union. And then finally, on the British side of things, Joe is going to look to the future and the possible constitutional implications. So he's just got the crystal ball. And then we'll finally turn to Nicola, who's going to talk about the French situation and constitutional stresses there. Speakers are meant to stick to 8 minutes, and hopefully then there'll be time for plenty of discussion. So, Richard, over to you.
Thank you very much. Well, as Julia just suggested, I think this is a very good week to be talking about constitutions under stress. I think that in terms of giving a historical perspective, a key point of comparison in terms of seriousness is the Edwardian constitutional crisis, which is usually dated sort of 1909 to 11. This was when the House of Lords rejected the so-called People's Budget and led to a great clash, which led to the end of the Lords' power of veto. But although this crisis is generally dated as 1909 to 11, it could be said that it actually lasted significantly longer and was only resolved by the independence of Southern Ireland in 1921-2. Now, it's often said that the UK does not have a written constitution, but in fact, what it lacks is a constitution codified into a single document. The constitution is written down, but in various different places. Now, this creates flexibility, although not perhaps unlimited flexibility, and it could be said that some parts of the constitution are more easily changed than others, or at least it's easier to change them without creating a great deal of noise and controversy. Now, skipping forward to the 1970s, I think there are sort of three key developments from the 1970s that I want to highlight. The first of these, of course, is accession to the EEC in 1973 and the referendum which confirmed Britain's membership in 1975. Now, during that referendum campaign, contrary to what was claimed during the recent referendum, it was highlighted that this was a major constitutional step which involved the sacrifice of some sovereignty. It wasn't just a trading club. People didn't believe they were only going into a set of economic arrangements. They realised they were told that it was a set of political arrangements as well. Now, this obviously was a huge matter of public debate, but subsequently the EEC, which then became the EC and then the EU, evolved over time in important ways which had considerable constitutional significance, but were not debated perhaps at the same level of public intensity as during the initial 1975 referendum. And so there are all sorts of developments which went on below the radar, if you like, including the ways in which British law in various ways became progressively Europeanised, if we're going to use that term. Now, the second development that I want to highlight was this innovation of the referendum itself. So that 1975 was the first national referendum in the UK, and this was a significant departure. The idea of the referendum had been discussed during the Edwardian period, but had not been used. Of course, there have been two further national referendums, one in 2011 over the proposed reform of the electoral system, and of course in 2016, as well as sub-national referendums in Northern Ireland, Wales and Scotland. Now, this didn't seem to create too many problems, this new system, as long as the government was on the winning side of the referendum. But the fact is that in the longer term, it set up at least the potential, which I think has now been realised, for a clash between ideas of representative and direct democracy. And this is what we see being at stake when people are arguing about, you know, the government has no option but to enact the will of the people as supposedly expressed through the referendum, versus those people who say that no, it is Parliament who should take the decision. So the third issue that I want to flag up is the constitutional reforms that took place after 1997. Now, these had their origins in perceptions of undemocratic behaviour or abuse of power, in particular by the Thatcher government in the 1980s. Now, some of you may well remember the organisation Charter 88, established in 1988, which demanded proportional representation, it demanded a British Bill of Rights, it demanded fixed-term parliaments, it demanded reform of the House of Lords, it demanded freedom of information, it demanded devolution. Now, a surprising amount of this agenda was achieved, not all of it, of course, but a surprising amount of it was achieved under the Blair government, although arguably this was really the legacy of John Smith's leadership of the Labour Party, and that Blair himself was indifferent, in some ways actually hostile to it, particularly if you read the section on freedom of information in Blair's autobiography. Now, again, all this was fine and didn't seem to cause too many problems, but progressed in parallel with the first set of developments that I was talking about the kind of progressive Europeanisation of the constitution. But in a sense, when this set of developments was taking place, thought wasn't given. Very understandably, because it was really kind of thought to be unthinkable, nobody thought about what the implications of all these changes would be, and especially devolution. I mean, this is the key one. Nobody thought about what the implications would be if Britain ever decided to withdraw from the EU. And so here we see the clash which was produced, which has been produced most notably with Scotland in the wake of the referendum. So to summarise, in a nutshell, the flexibility of the Constitution allowed parallel developments without a great deal of conscious thought, or at least a great deal of public debate about how these developments related to each other. And the referendum, in a way, became the kind of the constitutional weapon or the constitutional tool that can blow up in your face. Now, the Supreme Court judgment this week has provided some clarity over some of these issues, particularly with respect to devolution, but perhaps only at the cost of increasing some tensions within the Union, because Nicola Sturgeon and her supporters now perceive that that supposed guarantees given with respect to the devolution settlement, they now think that these were not worth the paper that they were written on. Now, how much does any of this matter? It's certainly inevitable. I mean, our theme is constitutions under stress, but it's inevitable that constitutions will come under stress from time to time. And we're certainly experiencing a drama. The question is, is it a full-blown crisis, or does it have to develop into one? It may turn out that the UK constitution is strong enough to surmount the current challenges. Now, from my perspective at least, it's clear that Britain's economy will experience huge and potentially destabilising changes post-Brexit. That's the economic and that's the social situation. But the question of whether our stressed constitution will become a broken constitution is one that, to my mind, still remains open. Thank you.
turning to the constitutional crisis as seen from the Supreme Court and Miller.
Thank you. One word of background, as you can tell from my accent, I'm not from the UK, but I do study basically UK politics and law, but that again is from a foreign perspective because my legal training is from the United States. So I kind of come at this with a different, slightly different lens. But to just hone in on the issue of, from a legal standpoint, and start with the actual words that we're having to deal with this crisis. Article 50 of the Lisbon Treaty has been the subject of the litigation that's been going on now for several months since the referendum passed in June. And basically, Article 50 has two sections that matter, the first of which says that when a state decides to leave the EU, and I'm quoting, in accordance with its own constitutional requirements, close quote, then the member state is allowed to give notice, and then there are time limits on how long the negotiations can take on, and all of the things with extensions have to be unanimously agreed between the 27 remaining members. So today we had the introduction of a bill which will be debated for 5 days in the coming 2 weeks, and which says that the Prime Minister, it says the Prime Minister, and this is all the operative language from the bill, the Prime Minister may notify under Section 50, Clause 2 of the Treaty on European Union the United Kingdom's intention to withdraw from the EU. So the reason that that is so short is that it's an effort to narrow the scope of the bill so that it won't be possible to amend that during the debates in the House of Commons and the House of Lords.
Well,
yeah, and we all hope that doesn't work. I didn't say that. You never heard that. That will be edited from the tape, and we'll move on. So what was the dispute? Really briefly, the dispute in Miller was basically whether a minister could give notice under Article 50 to the European Council of its intention to leave the EU based solely on the June referendum, whether that was enough. And the way that the Supreme Court decided it on Tuesday, if I put this in as few words as possible, is the answer is no, and that legislation is required because EU membership confers rights on UK citizens. Those rights are conferred because of a statute, and that's the European Communities Act that Richard was talking about from 1972. And statutory rights cannot be abrogated by a minister acting under the royal prerogative. Okay. Key terms to define here. One is the royal prerogative, and that is a body of powers that used to belong to the king or the queen, which have slowly been narrowed down into certain really tiny categories, one of which is the power to make treaties. And the idea here is that if the ministers can make foreign treaties without the permission of Parliament, they should also be able to say to withdraw from treaties. And that's why you get into the question of whether or not once that becomes domestic law because of the ECA 1972, then can the minister also pull us out of those once the rights have been conferred on the UK citizens. And there are different categories of rights. Not going to go there. Too complicated. Now, for me and for us, in this constitutional discussion, the really interesting question is this a constitutional decision? And I would argue that, interestingly, on the face of it, it's not that constitutional. Right? And this harkens back to, again, the point that Richard was making, that we don't have a codified constitution. So it's really hard to go to the constitution and say, I'm now going to reason based on these constitutional principles. So at a superficial level, it's constitutional because the Lisbon Treaty says we have to observe constitutional requirements, and the Supreme Court has just said what those constitutional requirements are. But really, most of it was statutory interpretation, right? It was what does the 1972 Act mean? What do statutes do? It was not rocket science. Let me just say, this is what's really obvious is to start at paragraph 40, and I really do recommend reading the judgment. It's parts at the beginning are kind of boring, but there are really good parts, like paragraph 40 and the six paragraphs after that are kind of important. And they're important because this claims to be a constitutional decision. And yet, here's what he says. He says exactly what Richard said. This isn't a codified constitution, and there's uses lovely language. Our constitutional arrangements, and they keep using the term constitutional arrangements, not constitution. I wonder why. But our constitutional arrangements have developed over time in a pragmatic as much as a principled way through a combination of statutes, events, conventions, academic writings, and judicial decisions. Now, my colleague Ian MacLean wrote a book on what's wrong with the British Constitution, and he spends a great deal of time on when the Queen is allowed to tell the Prime Minister to call an election. And it turns out that that convention comes from an anonymous letter written to the Times during the 1950s, right? So this is where our Constitution can be found, in the pages of the Times.
Before it was owned by Rupert Murdoch.
That's true. That is true. When it was the paper of record. So he refers to Dicey and says it's the most flexible polity in existence. Am I getting to my 8 minutes? I'm probably close. So the bottom line here is there's one paragraph that lists a period of statutes from 1689 to 1707. It says, yeah, these are really important statutes. Very little attention paid to why they're important statutes. Why are these statutes different from all other statutes? What do they say? What's the structure of the statute? None of that. It's just, these are important, and here's what they do. They establish an independent judiciary, they establish the rule of law, they establish that the judiciary is supposed to be responsible for the rule of law, and they say that Parliament is supreme. Well, that doesn't tell you very much. So one of the things that we're lacking here is the ability to reason carefully from statutes. We don't have the ability to go back and say, here's a constitutional statute, here's why it's a statute. And I just want to argue that that may be one of the reasons that we have some of the problems we do. I'm not claiming, by the way, that we should codify our constitution. I don't think that's possible in the UK context. What I do claim is that we need to reason much more carefully about why things are constitutional and why they operate constitutionally. Let me skip. Where am I? Have you looked?
You've got. Well, I'll let you have another minute.
Another minute? Okay. You know what? I'm going to stick with that. I'm going to make that claim, and that'll be my claim for the evening.
Joe.
Thank you. I agree with everything that you said. I want to just add something on the Miller case, because it was, or it could have been, a constitutional case. I agree, it falls a bit flat in the end, and the divisional court's decision in October was in many ways more constitutionally explosive than the Supreme Court decision. The Supreme Court, 2 days ago, yesterday? When was it?
Two days ago.
Had to essentially decide two questions. One, on the prerogative power to give notice to withdraw under Article 50 of the Lisbon Treaty. And the second question dealt with the role of the devolved assemblies and Parliament in relation to Article 50. And I want to come on to that in a second. But I am going to assume that not everyone in this room is a constitutional lawyer. Would I be correct in that assumption?
Yes.
So, and even if you are, as this case shows, even lawyers don't understand the Constitution. So here's kind of a three-line outline of the British Constitution. There are two sources of law in this country. An Act of Parliament, a statute that, as we know, stems from Parliament, so that's recognisably law, and the common law, that is the other legal source that's generated and recognised by courts. So they're not a problem. Then we have this third source of prerogative power, which is not a source of law, and that's why I agree with you. You said it's a source of power, a source of political power, which it is. It ultimately comes from the king, and the king, as we know, ruled by divine right, so the ultimate source of prerogative power is God. Neither of those are a recognised legal source. Now, for the past 400 years, what the courts in this country have been doing, and all these cases were cited in the Divisional Court and in the Supreme Court, as you rightly say, has been to curb not the existence and not the extent, but the exercise of a prerogative power, formerly by the king or the queen, and now by ministers acting on behalf of the crown. And they have been curbing them since the late 16th, early 17th century, and consistently the government has pretty much lost every case in which they relied on a prerogative power when they should have been relying on a statute. Interestingly, so one of the prerogative powers of right to sign treaties and all that, we've heard of that. Another prerogative power is the power to pardon. which the Queen doesn't exercise anymore. But the US president does. We saw Barack Obama, president Obama, in his dying days, pardon Chelsea Manning. Now that is an old, would have been an old prerogative power that now exists in the form of an executive power for the US president. Same with, you know, authorizing the building of wall. This is just an executive order that I suppose will have to be ratified in some shape or form by Congress, because that involves the spending of money. But we still see the prerogative power exist in the hands of the US president, and also in the hands of the French president, in the form of emergency powers recognized under the Constitution. So the mere existence of this third source, yes, it's constitutionally anomalous. It doesn't sit well with a state with a constitutional order based on the rule of law. But we see it in other countries as well. So that on its own, the mere existence of it, of a prerogative power, is not, I would say, constitutionally problematic. But the exercise of a prerogative power can very much so be constitutionally problematic. And with an 8-3 majority, the Supreme Court said that the only way to change the law in this country is by an act of Parliament, full stop. And even the dissenting judgment, I think, is a little confused on that matter. Lord Carnwath says at one point that the timing and process of Article 50 is not for the court to decide, it is for Parliament to decide. But the effect of the majority decision is to hand the decision to Parliament, so the court actually hasn't decided anything. The one area where the court could have made a big constitutional splash is by requiring involvement of the devolved assembly and devolved parliament in Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland. And had it done so, that would have, I think, recognised a radical constitutional shift in the British constitution since 1997 that now requires prior consultation and consent from Edinburgh, Cardiff and Belfast. And on the very narrow point, and this is where the decision falls a bit flat, because they limit it to Article 50, and they say, nah, Article 50 ultimately is a question for the Westminster Parliament, and Westminster Parliament has UK-wide representation, and so the case for involving the devolved assemblies is now less significant. However, I think this is paragraph 132 from memory, Lord Neuberger also, and the majority also say that as soon as rights are lost in Northern Ireland, then it would be, and I quote, incongruous if that loss of rights were not authorised by statute. So I think that it's a slightly cryptic paragraph, but I think what the UK Supreme Court is trying to say is, you don't need to be involved right now. After all, we're only triggering Article 50, and there will be a process of negotiation, and nothing follows from that. But if and when rights guaranteed to Northern Irish citizens are lost or diminished or in any way infringed, that's when, and by implication for Scotland and Wales, that is when consent from the devolved assembly needs to be sought. So, which incidentally is also a little bit odd, because in relation to prerogative powers, they said, well, the implications of triggering Article 50 are so fundamental and significant that we need an act of Parliament. And later they say, but actually it's not that significant, so you don't need to be involved, the devolved assemblies don't need to be consulted yet, but maybe at some point in the future. So I think that there's a tension running through the judgment. Now, constitutions under stress. I agree with your starting point. The Article 50 is an invitation by the European Union to say to member states, you can leave according to your own constitutional requirements. Now, how generous is that? And how embarrassing is it that the United Kingdom doesn't know what its own constitutional requirements are? It's not the European Union creating an obstacle here. It's our own. It's not that we have a constitution, but we don't have an understanding of our own constitution and how it works. And that is, well, I think it is embarrassing. And now we've got clarity from the United Kingdom Supreme Court, and now we're behaving like Americans. We don't know how to answer these questions, so we go to a court. But we have a political constitution, and it should be our MPs, it should be our parliamentarians who say, this is the correct political process, and not 11 unelected judges who tell us. That's with all respect, that's the American way, and not the British way. and the European way, but not the British way. But increasingly, we don't seem to have confidence in our own constitution. We don't have confidence in our own constitutional understanding, so we need to bring in experts. Now, and I think this does put the constitution under stress, because, well, for reasons that I've said, I also think, though, that I think there will be a respite from constitutional questions. The prerogative question has now been answered. The devolution question has been suspended. I think for the next few weeks and months, we will be talking about the collapse or consolidation of the Labour Party and maybe other parties. I think the focus will now be on politics. I think over the next few years and decades, we will be talking about the collapse or consolidation of the United Kingdom. And I think that, so I think further pressures will come on the United Kingdom, and I don't know what the answer is. I think, you know, talks of a border poll in Northern Ireland, talks of a hard border, which would be inevitable if Northern Ireland has to leave the EU and the Republic of Ireland stays within the EU. You have to have a land border, but Theresa May doesn't want a land border, but nor does she want, seeming she's prepared to walk away from the single market, so that is an issue that needs to be addressed. You cannot stop Nicola Sturgeon from talking about a Scottish IndyRef 2, a second independence referendum. And it doesn't, you can hit her with the Westminster Doctrine all you like. In Scotland, the doctrine of parliamentary sovereignty has never rung true. The Scots have their own understanding of sovereignty, and it's one of popular sovereignty. And this is only going to alienate the Scots even more, although we have to see where that goes. I'm not making any predictions. So I think, you know, referendums in those two parts of the United Kingdom is at least a theoretical possibility. There is talk increasingly of the United Kingdom federalising. It's Kezia Dugdale in Scotland, Scottish Labour leader, who is talking about a new Act of Union. There are parliamentarians as well in the House of Lords that are saying that Lord Strathclyde and his Constitution Reform Group are talking about a new Act of Union where, in one sentence, the devolution settlement would be inverted. So currently Westminster is sovereign and decentralises power to the regions. By inverting that, you would make Scotland, Wales, Northern Ireland and England autonomous, and they would transfer power to Westminster, right on the kind of the important matters like defence or taxation or the royal family.
And is that one sentence going to be your final sentence, or would you like another minute?
No, I just want to find the third option, I suppose, is centralism, but I don't think that's an option. The status quo is not an option, and centralism is not an option. So we're somewhere between collapse and consolidation. I don't know.
Channel. Yeah. What's the situation in France?
Yes, thank you. If I have understood well my British colleagues, the British problem is not to have one written constitution, or at least one coherent constitution. And our problem in France is to have, or to have had, too many constitutions. As you know, we are sort of champions of the world for once, because we had maybe 13 or 15 constitutions in our history. And as you know, we are with the French Republic number 5. And many people are talking about French Republic number 6. So it is a general statement in France, a sort of general agreement that the French constitution is under stress. But we are in France. There is a general disagreement about the solutions and possible remedies for the crisis of the Fifth Republic. But to illustrate this crisis, or so-called crisis of the French Fifth Republic, I think there are two different things. First, we can do a bit of history, recent history, and one could say that from the beginning of our century, around 2000, we get into a series of changes and even of constitutional amendments. One was the change of the presidential term coming from the septennat, 7 years, to the quinquennat, five years. And for many observers, it has been a very important change. The other change was the revision, the amendment of the Constitution in 2008, strangely enough, under Nicolas Sarkozy, because it was an amendment with the objective to strengthen the parliament and to try to have a new balance, if you want, between the presidency and the parliament. That's the first thing. We are, obviously, we are in a sort of a new cycle of changes. And that's new for the Fifth Republic. And nobody knows if this cycle will end, and if we will have new revision, new amendments to the Constitution, and maybe it will lead us to a sort of destruction, piece by piece, change by change, of the Fifth Republic. So that's the question. The other, if you want, the other sign of this new mood, if I may, if I can use that word, the new mood, political mood in France, is if you look at the candidates for the, you know, the next presidential election, whether in the primaire, the primaries from the left or from the right, or the candidates for the presidential election, it seems that all of them, each of them, has something to say about the change of the constitution. If you look at very deeply, there is no coherence of the proposals, but there is a sort of obligation for all the candidates. They have to say something. They have to propose something on the constitution and on new solutions. And just briefly to give you a picture of the different proposals from the left and from the right. From the left, it seems that there is a tension between one part of the left who wants to give more strength to the parliament, because the ideal of a parliamentarian republic has never been erased from the tradition of the French left. There is still a nostalgia, in a way, for the, maybe not for the Fourth Republic, but for a more balanced republic between the parliament and the president, the executive power and the legislative power. But on the other side, you will see more and more different candidates from the left who would like to introduce in the next constitution tools or instruments coming from participative democracy, whether citizen juries, so you say that in English, mm-hmm. citizen juries, drawing by lots, popular referendum, all that sort of new ideas coming from the direct democracy inspire some of the candidates of the left. So you have this tension for the left. For the right, you have another type of strain or tension. You have one part of the right who are obviously nostalgic for the period during the Fifth Republic was a strong one with strong presidents, if you want, the Republic of de Gaulle. So one part of the members of the right are a bit lost with the new trend of the current Fifth Republic, and they don't know what to do. Even some of them say that we should go back to the septennat, that we should go back to the term of seven years to in order to have again to have a stronger president. And you also have, it is a case of François Fillon the candidate of the right. You have members of the right, they want to use the tools, the very powerful tools for the executive, for the presidency. And they want to, in a way, to have a fifth republic in overdrive. In French, we say sur régime. It means that they want to use the Fifth Republic, government by ordinances, to govern by decrees or executive orders, the same type that Trump uses in the last week. So we may have that if François Fillon is elected, a sort of 100 days, you know, the first 100 days with ordinances, presidential decrees, and not laws voted by the parliament. So you have this sort of large, very large variety of proposals among the French candidates. I don't say that this constitutional issue is the most popular for the French citizens. Obviously, the French voters are more interested, and you understand why when you live in France, are more interested by the economic issues, the issue of the security, the attacks, the terrorism. But still, I think it is a new thing in the French history of the Fifth Republic, that the Constitution is not taken for granted, and it is now a real issue which is in the core of the political debate, and has brought something new in French politics. But I want to end by a final statement, which is between the partisans of the Fifth Republic, the ones who want to whether to keep the Fifth Republic as it is, as a strong presidential republic, because in our time, in European situation, it might be a good thing to keep a strong republic. And you have on the other side the partisans of the Sixth Republic, like for instance Benoît Hamon, who probably will be the candidate for the Socialist Party after the primary of next Sunday. Benoît Hamon is a partisan of the Sixth Republic, but it is my personal opinion. I think that both sides, they tend to forget one issue which, in my opinion, is even more important, is the issue of the European Union. In the French debate, political debate today, it was the case for the primary of the right in November. It is the same thing for the primary of the left in January. They don't talk about the crisis of the European Union. And my opinion is to have this typical French battle between whether we do have a Fifth Republic or a Sixth Republic. It's a sort of guerre franco-française, you know, just sort of French typical battle. And it seems to me old-fashioned. And for my opinion, the target, the priority should be on the reflection, constitutional reflection. I know that you are leaving the EU, so you might be not interested by my final point. But I think our French and German, our priority will be to shape a real constitution, if it is possible, a real constitution for the European Union. And if you want not to be trapped into the French typical debate, which is, you know, a sort of French game, and then to go further and to go to the very difficult, as you know, very difficult topic of the European Union.
Thank you. very much indeed. I agreed to be discussant as well as chair, but I'm not going to take very long discussing anything. I'm going to raise one quick point on each of the presentations and then throw the floor open for comments or questions. I may have missed something, Nicola, in your comments.
It's because of my English.
No. I may perhaps have been thinking of the sort of constitutional history of France and not heard, maybe I missed, you mentioning Marine Le Pen or the far right generally. And you ended up with a question of something that those of us who are European idealists would very much like, a European constitution, and that that's where France and Germany wants to go once the United Kingdom leaves the European Union. Is that really the reality in France and Germany in the 21st century? So keep that one till we come back to answers.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. As I said, it was my sort of personal opinion at the end. It might be a bit idealistic. In the current opinion in France, there is not a party or not a movement towards a reformed European Union. And that's a big problem. As you know, as I said, the French candidates, whether from the left or from the right, they focus on the French constitution. And they just forget that if you want to change this malaise between the French citizens and the constitution, the best thing is to try to reform the functioning of the European Union, because policies, and especially economic policies, are made through the European Union, and that's the main target. But that's why I said it was a trap. It is a trap, because by amending the French constitution, you will not find a solution for the French economic policies. We are not anymore French. We used to have very ambitious economic policies until the 80s. I remember, I was young, but I remember the economic policies under Mitterrand. You know, they said that by the French money, the franc, by the French central bank, by the control of the credit, we will have a magic circle, a Keynesian circle, and it was presented as a French, a national policy. Now it's not possible anymore. So I just say that it is, for me, it is a bit childish. Could you say that? Childish to...
Or naive?
Naive. Like a child.
Okay.
Because French are very naive for that. It's a bit childish to have arguments. Should we keep the Fifth Republic? Should we go to the Sixth Republic? Without thinking about the European Union.
Yeah, okay. Thank you. So just three very quick their comments, not really questions, but the 1975 referendum, there seems to be a difference of memory depending on which side of the argument you were in 2016. So those people advocating leave said, no, it was all a discussion about economics in 75. And those people advocating remain said, no, we talked about sovereignty and there was a big debate about it. If you look back at the debates in Parliament and so on, there was clearly a discussion about sovereignty. And yet, for the last 20 years, if you were active in politics, talking to voters, people said, I never voted to join a political union, I voted to join a common market. So, and I think there isn't necessarily... what may or may not have happened in 75 in terms of what was said and whether the politics was articulated, what was remembered by so many people is what then fed into their thinking in the referendum in 2016. So this is a sort of comment. I muttered as an aside about the short bill that Scott said, well, it's kept short so it's not really going to be amendable. That's what the government is hoping, and I sort of muttered, well, chance, you know, they don't hold your breath, because clearly there are going to be a lot of amendments coming forward. There's a difference between the Commons and the Lords. The Speaker can rule amendments out and decide which amendments will be debated in the Commons. In the Lords, if amendments are fit, the, you know, they fit the rules, if the clerks say that amendment is valid, then it can be debated. So you can have a huge number of amendments, and while it would arguably be overstretching their constitutional powers for the Lords to try and block the triggering of Article 50, there is nothing to stop the Lords putting forward an awful lot of amendments that say to the lower house, the elected chamber, think again. Think about how you're triggering Article 50. So there may be many hours of debate coming. And I did have a point for Joe, but I'm going to leave it for the moment because there are lots of hands going up. So, gentleman with the red... Yes, there.
Hello. LOC, class of 1977 to 80. I'm just old enough to remember that we were lied to for the purposes at the time of joining a common market in order to improve our economy. Surely, I know we're talking about a constitutional matter here, but this is fiddling around the edges. Constitutions aren't a threat. It's the whole status of our economies and the disconnect between the political classes and the people that has been manifest in the last year. Whether you like it or not, the people in charge don't know what the hell they're doing. And the people down under in the cold room have said, enough. Now, I think, incumbent on all of us to try and think through how we progress in the future, given where we are. Not trying to fight the battles of yesterday or the day before. And I'd be very interested in Mr. Roussillier's notion of where we are in Britain vis-à-vis Europe. You're saying France hasn't really confronted the problems of Europe and the EU, but we have chosen to ignore it by stepping away, but perhaps there are lessons to be learned on both sides.
Right, I'm going to take a group of people, and then I'm not sure, we're supposed to finish at 8:30, I don't know if we spontaneously combust if we carry on, but gentlemen with the denim shirt and a beard, and then I'll come forward and then go to that side.
We here in the UK do not have a constitution. This is quite a sick lie. What we have here is random bits of paper. Billionaires, landowners, the title, and Oxbridge choose to call law when it suits them. Therefore, we live in therefore the sick world that we live in is a reflection of their sick world, of billionaires, these billionaires, landowners, titles, and Oxbridge. If we want to call it we, and if you want to use this term we as a constitution, then the people of this country should be entitled create their own constitution and use that as law and go forward in the future for any issues that do come up regarding the population of England and the world. Thank you.
Thank you. Guy just behind the first speaker and then chap with the beard. Yeah. Don't you? Yes.
I'm slightly hesitant to ask this question because I'm worried it's somewhat orthogonal to the issues already raised. There's something that underlay a lot of the debate around during the Brexit debate. And so, since I've got you here...
But briefly.
Is there a particularly good reason, other than historical coincidence, other than just the fact that we are where we are, is there a particularly good reason why the nation state is deemed to be the appropriate level of governance? Because that seems to be...
Right, OK, stop there. Gentleman with the beard, and then I'm going to go that way and then round back that way.
Just a point to Mr. Merkins that, when you raise the question if there are any constitutional lawyers in the room, but I would just say that since Brexit, we're all constitutional lawyers. And my serious point was that the constitutional point is that how does the House of Lords get to vote on this, whereas the elected devolved assemblies don't?
Very quickly, from the gentleman before, it's not the idea of the will of the people that we've had hugely in politics in the last year. That's something very new in the British constitution, in a sense, that we didn't ever talk about the will of the people. It was the Parliament, the sovereign, or the monarch, the sovereign. And a very quick question about the French elections. If Emmanuel Macron is elected, will that not create some kind of constitutional or political crisis because he doesn't have a party base?
No. I'm going to take three more interventions and then the speakers have each got a minute to answer. So,
Isn't the battle between whether you legislate for precepts or not, and isn't that what Blair did in the sense that he took these conversations that were going on in Middle England and legislated for them? When I was growing up, the British Constitution was defined by precepts in a nice accent. That kind of basically defined how people lived their lives and how communities came together.
Right.
I'm a lawyer, but I think that the Constitution is something that you can ascertain. It is, just because it's not in one document doesn't mean that it's not clear and that we can't discover what it is. But for me, I take a different angle on it and say it was the question that was put that created the chaos, because when the question was put,
yes,
it was recognized as being a constitutional question in two ways. One, it wasn't identified. It wouldn't have been hard to say Article 50 requires this to be done in accordance with our constitution, so this is a constitutional question. But also, it wasn't acknowledged that after 40 years as part of the EU laws and so on are part of our constitution. And so if you're going to vote to leave in a yes, no way, you're going to, the unstitching is going to be a constitutional exercise.
We'll take one more, if there's one hand. No. Just very quickly, the point that I didn't raise on Joe's goes absolutely to the point of why will the House of Lords have a vote and not the devolved assemblies? Because this is a piece of primary legislation which goes through the two chambers, the Commons and the Lords. And I think that Joe said there's a tension in the Supreme Court's ruling, but I think the logic is that the European Union is a reserved power. When we get into the discussions about the future relationship, and then we're looking at agricultural policy and all sorts of other things which would naturally be devolved, then I think that's the point why the devolved administrations come in.
I think that's
right,
yeah.
Right, who would like to start with it, Joe?
Yeah, I'd like to kick off. And I think the great questions, and I think that they're all kind of linked, and I'd especially like to tie your question to another question. So I'm not sure if we were lied to in 1975. Ministers knew very well that the project of European integration was not just an economic matter for the original six. It was always a federal project. And in fact, they used the word and they said, this is a federal project. If we take part in it now, we can shape it. But if we wait another 10 years and then join it, then we will have missed the bus and we won't be able to shape it anymore. But it was the sovereignty aspect, and I've gone through the parliamentary debates of the 60s and 70s, the sovereignty aspect was played down deliberately because it was not an issue on which you could win the popular vote or even the parliamentary majority. So that was a strategic decision to talk up the economy and to talk down the sovereignty. So it was a kind of lie in a political sense, but it wasn't a lie in that those in charge didn't know what they were doing. Right. But that's also a deliberate, what I'm saying is just a deliberate choice not to frame it in constitutional or political terms, but in economic, and I think that's a foreshortening of the whole issue. To the gentleman at the back who said that, this is just an elite stitch-up, and I would say the cynical part of me agrees with you, but I think all constitutions are elite stitch-ups. They whether you have a written one in the name of we the people, or whether you have a kind of imaginary, made-up, historical constitution, it's...
Constitution is actually owned by the people. They're not owned by the people, so therefore it's...
Yeah, but the people of 300 years ago, and there are a lot of people that feel disenfranchised in the US Constitution. It has not worked for everyone equally. So we the people is a nice normative aspirational reference point, which we don't have. You're right, it's Parliament that is sovereign here. We don't know how to fit popular sovereignty into our constitutional frame. We have a system of parliamentary sovereignty. We also don't understand constitutional sovereignty and kind of the role of the Supreme Court in this. So all of this is in flux. But as a general point, I think, since Hobbes and Locke, law has always worked for those in charge and struggled to keep up with the rest of everyone.
Scott.
I'm going to just take the one quick point about that answers a number of these, I think, and that is there's there's an approach to things in political science that we call historical institutionalism. And if you think about Karl Marx and how he says, we make our own history, but not on our own terms, and the institutions are there, and we live in an environment that's made. This is where we live. This is the answer to the question about the nation state, right? I mean, there's a whole historical reason that these things, basically wars is the answer, right? Wars. And so a lot of these things were just kind of encased in this stuff. What is a shame is when we can't use the tools that we have to try to build what we need, right? If we have available resources that we could be using and we're not, that's when we make bad mistakes. And
thank you.
Very briefly, just on this question about, you know, the people versus the people in charge, right? It's obviously it goes to the root of a lot of the rhetoric. Now, it seems to me that there's you can argue that the people are in charge, are useless, that they're fools, and that they're liars. But of course, who was it who elected them? It was the people. So what the people have said is, well, you know, this is terrible, we want something new. But in fact, the same people are going to be entrusted with undoing all these arrangements and withdrawing from the European Union. So in a sense, it's kind of very wishful thinking to think that the same bunch of people who you've just announced as completely out of touch are going to arrive at a very satisfactory and beneficial solution. So it's like magical thinking, in my view.
What is the alternative?
What's the alternative?
Revolution.
Nicola, the last word to you.
I am the one who can speak about the revolution.
After lunch.
just a quick answer for your question about Emmanuel Macron. A very good English speaker, I think. That's a problem, because you can't have a government under the Fifth Republic if you don't have a majority. Not only a majority for the election, but a majority in the parliament. That's the reason why this mixture of republic is still a parliamentary republic in a way. But the thing is, the speculation is that Emmanuel Macron, if he wins the election, he will probably shape a new sort of post-socialist new party with many elements of the former socialist party, like many members of the parliament today who are members of the socialist party will go into that new party just for the reason that they want to be re-elected in June. As you know, we will have another election 1 month after the presidential election. So the speculation is that he has a network already of parliament of MPs and of journalists, and this network is just the new basis for a new party.
Thank you. I'm not sure whether we've actually solved any problems this evening. We seem to have raised a few about the nature of elites versus people, which was clearly one of the issues in the whole Brexit debate in the UK, in the election of Trump in the United States, and is something that I think is facing many other European countries. One of the real changes is not just globalisation, which we talk about a lot, but moves in information technology, social media, and a whole range of changes that mainstream politicians haven't got to grips with, and some of the populist leaders do a much better job. So in terms of getting to ordinary citizens. So there are a set of problems that are facing the political class in France, in the UK, and elsewhere. Some of them also leading to constitutional crises. I very much hope that the French embassy will continue having further soirées where we can discuss similar issues, because I think the discussion's been great. Thank you all very much for your questions. Sorry I didn't get here.